from Buffalo Toronto Public Media. This is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Good morning, and welcome to another episode of What's Next. I'm executive producer Charles Gilbert. On today's show, filmmaker Rocco Anastasio joins Jay Moran to talk about his program Buffalo Latino Lens and how he is working to put a positive spotlight on the Latino community. We also travel to Olean, where Jay catches up with Della Moore for an update on the African American Center for Cultural Development. But first, we begin with BTPM's Dallas Taylor and a conversation with Maria Ta, the new executive director of Ujima Company. Maria was appointed earlier this year, and she shares her vision for the company and its legacy moving forward.
What about your journey through just the arts field in general? And can you talk a little bit about that and how that's led up to where you are now?
Yeah, I've had a pretty winding journey when it comes to my creative journey. I never really sought out to have a creative journey to begin with. I always like to tell people, if you look at my resume and my professional path on paper, it doesn't make sense how I landed where I landed. I didn't go to school for the arts. I was never trained in the arts. It was a thing that I did as an aside, because for those of you who understand, I come from an immigrant household. So like that was not a thing.
Yeah.
So I went to school for international relations and political science, thinking I was going to go to law school or become a diplomat or something like that. And then straight out of my undergrad degree, I kind of landed at Ujima by accident through friends who just wanted me to check out what was going on and lend a helping hand. And from there, that really sparked the trajectory of my adult creative journey, I'd say. I started to learn really intentionally what the arts could do for people in reality, how it could be a vehicle for change beyond just like a theory or just a dream. Or you watch it in the movies, it's like, oh, they put on this nice little play and all of the town gets together and it's so happy and go lucky. And I got to experience that in real time as like my first real professional theater experience at Ujima. And that really has colored every other step along the way. I started to discover that my gifts and my talents really mirrored and complemented the work that artists were doing. I explored my own artistry in the last couple of years as well. So it's been truly rewarding, and I can honestly tack that back to Ujima. So being able to come full circle and be back around as the executive director now feels like a coming home story.
Yeah, and it's funny how that kind of always works out, especially for artists, because I had the same similar journey where I was in college, had a minor in law, a minor in political science, international relations. And it's like, this is not really working out for me. But then jumping into the arts and finding the voice in poetry, just kind of how it all just kind of leads you into the right where you're supposed to be.
Yeah.
Right. What is Ujima? Because that's a story in and of itself, that theater company. And so what is that? What do you feel that represents to Buffalo, like that theater company in general, like their mission, the purpose for Ujima?
For folks who don't know, we're coming up to our 50th anniversary pretty quickly. And we were established in 1978, but the collective that started Ujima had been practicing as artists, as company members for quite a number of years before we were incorporated on paper. So we're probably at around 50 years of folks in and around Buffalo who've been doing work with Ujima can tack on to. So we're one of two African-American theater companies in the area, the other one being at the Masson Center at the African-American Cultural Center. The Paul Robeson Theater is our sister theater. And the work that we're doing is representing the things that you don't see on Broadway, you know, the things that you don't see on really big stages, the stories that often are told around kitchen tables or at your family's barbecue, or you hear them in the church on Sundays, but you don't see them as a commercial space, as being celebrated in a really beautiful beautiful and large scale, like in a theater production. So the work that we've always done and that we continue to do is 110% reflective of the communities we all come from and the communities that we then serve. So we're lucky that we are physically embedded in an actual neighborhood. Like, we're not part of a specific business district. I walk out and there's rows of houses in front of the building. There's people who are just living their lives. There's families. There's kids running around. There's kids playing on our playground. All of that stuff has narrated what we do inside the walls of our theater. So I'm always looking forward to building out that legacy and always being reactive to what is the community needing in this time. And that changes from year to year, but it always stays true that we want it to be a welcoming space for people who don't feel comfortable in art spaces.
Yeah. And as the executive director, what is your vision going forward for Ujima? Like, what does that look like moving forward?
Yeah, I think that's a complicated question because it's such a big legacy to step into.
Yeah.
A lot of it has to do with continuing the excellence in artistry that's always been embedded in our work. I want to build us out into a professional sphere where people are going to Ujima specifically for the craft that Lorna has created and started for us. We're going to try to copyright some stuff and build out new pedagogy and rewrite some history. So it's all very big, lofty dreams, but building on the shoulders of our ancestors.
Yeah. And you speak of Lorna, we mentioned her name before. How do you hope to honor that legacy of Lorna and just what she's built and everything that she's done for Ujima and for Buffalo in general?
For sure. What comes to mind for me is one of the last things that she left with all of us prior to her passing was this idea of always putting love and justice in front of us at the forefront. You always hear about justice being on the side of you, being behind you. But this was the first time for me that somebody who I respected and looked at as a leader, as a mentor, telling me that that should be your North Star. So honoring her legacy means that making sure our work is always putting love and justice in front of us. That is the thing that guides us. That is the thing that moves our work, moves our people, how we move about in the world ourselves. And then the second notion is this tenet of excellency. I've been instilled with that by a lot of matriarchs in my life, but no more than Lorna C. Hill, and being able to work with her professionally for the number of years that I did. Her strive for excellency, no matter what we did, whether that's like a report or how you show up to a meeting or what you're putting out on stage. I want to be able to make sure that the work that Ujima's name is being tied to is of the most excellent caliber, as it always has been. And it really is so amazing and powerful to see how many young people, how many of our elders who are still in the room really adhering to that policy and rising to that occasion.
That is really cool to see. I see that a lot too as well. I remember last year I was asked to come in with Brandon Williamson, who was running some of the Dunbar Project, and it was like a poetry workshop. And to just see those young kids just even writes, even freestyle stuff, like just going up there and just using their voice, using their art, their storytelling. It was amazing to see, like, it's instilled at a young age and they're embracing it. That is a really cool sight to see when I was there. What's next? Kind of look ahead. What are your biggest hopes for the next phase of your journey and Buffalo's future at Ujima?
Oh, man. I don't like to hope too far in advance, you know? It's kind of scary. My biggest hopes for myself are that I stay true to the purpose and intention that got me here. That I continue to forge a path for the generations that are coming behind me. I'm always, always thinking about the baton passing. I never want to think about any of the spaces that I occupy as this is where I land forever. I want it to be like I have the honor of being in this place at this time. So what will I do with it? So I hope that I can find more time and space to explore my own artistry, my own craft, be able to continue to inspire other people, especially other young people, to really rise and be a part of the process that we're all in right now. And for Ujima and our arts community, I'm hoping that we really band together. It's going to be incredibly tough for a lot of us in the next few years, if not right now. I know that a lot of us are hurting and are scared and are unsure about what the future is ahead. But I hope that that doesn't deter people from doing what is right. I think there's been a lot of conversations about how do we survive? Mm-hmm. How do we survive the next couple of years? And the only way we have survived before and the only way we can survive is together, is trying to figure out how do we engage with one another. If I know of opportunities for funding, opportunities for your work, I'm going to share it immediately. This isn't a time for us to hoard resources or to try to be self-preservationists. So I'm hoping that for the arts community, we end up on the other side of this stronger and more united as a community that's really flourishing when it comes to the arts.
And then finally, on a more personal level, we've talked about it a little bit throughout the last couple of minutes, but why does this work still matter? Like, why do what we do as artists, why does that still matter?
I think it's not even a question of why it still matters. It's why it matters, period. And I think that's a question that a lot of artists get often. But whenever I look up and look around, we're surrounded by art. We're surrounded by art in such a multitude of forms that it can't be ignored. And the importance of adhering to art and being able to continue to hold on to our craft and our art form is that we are all historians. Without that art form and without our art practice, we lose a piece of our history. We lose a piece of the story. And it's both a curse and a blessing that if you have a talent and you have the ability to create and to memorialize moments in life in your art form, that you do it, because without that, there's nothing to look back on and there's nothing to learn from. So I think that every story is part of this larger quilt, this larger story of life that we're all sharing, and that if we lose even a tiny thread of it, it creates a hole. No matter how small of a hole it is still a hole. So I hope that people will continue to take that blessing and that opportunity to patch it up.
That was Dallas Taylor with Maria Ta. Next, over the summer, Jay Moran traveled to Olean to speak with Della Moore, executive director of the African American Center for Cultural Development, about the latest updates from the center.
So let's talk about what the summer has been like so far for you. I know the summers tend to be busy for you.
We had our Juneteenth over at Bethany Lutheran Church. That's one of our favorite spots to have it. And someone asked me, well, why don't we have it here at the center? But it's the center's too small. Mm-hmm. And for the past four Juneteenths, it's rained. So and we couldn't bring everybody in the center of it, but that we can do at Bethany Lutheran Church. Now, that's right on Buffalo Road. Leo Morse Drive.
Right.
Yeah, right beside the food pantry.
Okay.
And it's a beautiful church, and lots of room. And it has a pavilion on the property, so our band can be there, our food can be there, and everything can be right there. And when it rains, if it rains, we run inside the church, and we have a nice place there too.
What was the turnout like this year?
I think about maybe 25, 30 people.
Yeah. Are people still learning about Juneteenth? Mm-hmm. I mean, is that turned into as much of an educational event as a celebration?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, this time there were people I had not seen at any of our Juneteenths before. But yes, the people are still learning about Juneteenth and, of course, about the Black history and per se. Still doing that.
Let's talk about the interest in black history.
Okay.
Are you seeing more? Like, you know, we just had a couple of surprise guests here just a little while ago. All right. So I guess the answer there is there is a more of an increase in the history. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. We had, in fact, we did our walking tour. We did a walking tour for Trinity United Methodist Church. And so we walked, and of course it rained. And I mean big time rain, Jay, big time rain. We were all bunched up in our umbrellas and everything and all. And it was, in fact, one of my friends at the church said, I found out that if you want to hang out with Della, bring your umbrella. Because it was boom, 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 raining and stuff. And we had pretty good turnout. I think maybe 12, 15 people.
Okay.
Walking and all that slush and stuff. And I didn't lose any of them, you know.
That's good.
And I tend to lose them, you know, at Oak Hill Park. Remember that?
I remember Oak Hill Park.
Yeah, so I went around that. again, yeah.
What do you attribute that to? The increase in the interest in Black history, increased interest in Juneteenth. What do you make that about?
I don't know. I hope it's because people want to find out their history, and if it's not their particular history, then the history of people you know, I really do. I hope it's that, because that's a healthy thing. Of course, no politics. We're not going to talk
about
politics.
No, we don't have to go politics.
No. This is just off the top of my head. Sojourner Truth said, agitate enough to make someone interested in their history. God bless them. Thank you so much. I'm sorry you have to worry about it that way, but whatever gets you moving,
right?
Then let's do it. And I'm certainly willing.
Yeah. No doubt. Yeah. And there's also, I guess it's an unfortunate reality, but it's a reality, and it's also what I've learned and what people have told me, people who live it, that when it comes to, you know, the one thing they can always say about a Black cultural commonality is resiliency.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think the last time we talked about how I wasn't very enthusiastic about Black history, about history, social studies, they used to call it when I grew up, because I didn't see me there except for the people in chains. And when the people that I learned from taught in the classroom about slavery, then they didn't talk about the resilience. They didn't talk about the bravery. They didn't talk about the faith to go from one to leave a place that you know, treats you so poorly, because there's something else out there, you know. And freedom is one of them. And they didn't have GPS, you know, at that time, you know. And all they had to do is their faith and the star. And as Sarah Johnson said, the geese, when it was really cloudy out, when she couldn't see the stars, and she followed the geese.
She followed the geese north.
Yes.
You know, when we had our two visitors here just a little while ago, you gave a brief Sarah Johnson history, and that you told me the story again, but it's a really inspiration. Hers is a really inspirational story.
She was born on a plantation in Maryland. It's brave to me, because I get lost in Portville. You know, and you give me a dark street like Cranberry Road, and I don't travel that way. So anyway, she left the plantation and went across the creek and up a hill in back of the plantation, and she watched. Now, this is awesome. This was not, I mean, these kind of things were not told, and I would have enjoyed that. I would have been yes, in the back of the classroom if this was told me in school. So she stayed on the top of the hill. The dogs and everything was trying to find her. You know, they had the hunters out and doing what have you. And of course, they lost her scent when crossed the creek. But anyway, and then they would go back to rest for the night, maybe, and the next day go after her again. So when they went back, after they went to sleep, Sarah would come back down, recross the hill creek, and then go get some more stuff to eat, and then go back up again. She did it for 10 days.
Whoa.
10 days, according to her own primary source.
Sure.
10 days. And so finally she figured that they'd given up. So then she started her trek to on the Underground Railroad North.
Wow.
And all. Can you imagine the bravery of that? Can you imagine?
No.
She wound up here in 1833, and she wound up at the blacksmith shop right there where Blueberry Square is now, mm-hmm. and all. And they had never seen a black person before. Yes. Yep. They thought she was a black bear. Yeah.
So we're back here in Olean. Mm-hmm. We're talking with Della Moore, mm-hmm. one of the founders and the executive director of the African American Center for Cultural Development. So how's the center doing? What, 2 years? 2 years now that it's been in this great location, this beautiful location over here next to Jamestown Community College. Oh, yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. Well, we got it on in 2021, right after the COVID.
Yeah.
Right, and we've been working on it ever since. And everything. Yeah. But grand opening was, I think it was 2 years ago. It's a work in progress, and it's a labor of love.
Of course.
Yeah. Yes.
So what's next? I mean, you know, this is a big endeavor, and you've got to keep things moving along here. Yeah. And I know you're adding on, you're creating new spaces, adding new artifacts. Yeah. What's next?
Yeah, we're going to try to get upstairs started. It started already. We have when you come next time, I'll be brave enough to take you up there because it's not ready for prime time yet.
That's fine.
We're getting our bookcases up in the reading room. We have tons of books that people can just research, et cetera. And a lot of them come from my library, and a lot of them come from donation. Others come from donations. Let's see what else immediately that we're doing. Our kitchen is done now. Good. And I'm going to work and get all those things out of the way so that my sister can set up the way she has. She's the chief cook.
Right.
She's the one that told you that used to be a mess sergeant.
Oh, okay, all right. Yeah, right. And she's the one with the ribs.
Yes. I'll do the Philly cheesesteak, but she does the ribs. Yes.
When you're talking about Sarah Johnson.
Yes, okay.
And, mm-hmm. you know, we don't, you know, she was in Maryland, but we don't really necessarily know where she was born because there were records for that. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering about how both the impact of maybe the lack of records along the way for African Americans, how that's impacted understanding the history and how it, you know, makes it maybe whatever a challenge for you, or maybe you find a way to get around it. Yeah,
I'll use myself for instance. That, no, I'd like to know more about. I can only go back to my grandmother's. My grandmother. That's as far as I can go back to. And my sister's working on it, but that's as far as we got so far. And my children are begging me to write about my life. Honestly, it's important. I don't blame either African Americans or anybody who, through circumstances other than their own, and you know what I'm talking about, you know, not knowing, you know, their history, but I feel that if you don't know it, it's like you're like there's no roots. Mm-hmm. The roots is not there, you know. And this little girl in 1940s. Sitting in a classroom and listening to social studies that did not speak to her at all. Mm-hmm. And then to come home and have television, television in 56, be the last one on our block to get home. But, you know, on the newspaper and what have you like that, and not, you know, there's nothing that looked like you, you know, like that. And after a while, it starts to seep in and creep in. So, and either you get into it or you do something about it. And you research your own way. You know, I was fortunate because my family was, they taught me about black history and whatever, but they taught me. So it was they were my anchor, you know, like that.
As the history becomes more known and more complete, and you know, as complete as it can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's hope for the future.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, big time, absolutely. Big time, absolutely, yes.
And finally, we close with filmmaker Rocco Anastasio. In his conversation with Jay, Rocco emphasizes the importance of accurate and respectful media representation of Latinos and how his program, Buffalo Latino Lens, is showcasing the community's positive contributions.
A lot to talk about. You've got a variety of experiences, including experiences right here inside this very building that is home now to Buffalo Toronto Public Media, of course, known as WNED before the name changed not too long ago. But you're going to say something. Look like you had a comment.
I was going to say, it's always going to be WNED TV.
Yeah.
I grew up in the Lower West Side, and I don't care how many times they call it, you know, Ralph Wilson Park. That's always going to be
LaSalle Park. So. I can appreciate that for sure. I struggle to change the call letters. That's why I say them right off the bat to start this program all the time to remind myself of that. I want to get into so many of the different elements, Rocco, of course, but, you know, through thick and thin, you're a Lower West Sider. You come from the heart of the city of Buffalo, especially when it comes to the Hispanic heritage as well. What was it like growing up in the Lower West Side?
You know, it's funny. I tell people all the time, you know, of course, my name, Rocco Anastasio, it's a very Italian name. I get that from my dad. He was an Italian immigrant. My mother, she's Puerto Rican. So, you know, we were talking off mic here before we started. Yeah, I made Lower West Side story. I definitely am. But growing up in the Lower West Side during the mid to late 80s, 90s, looking back, the experiences that I had, they shape me. A lot of people, they might remember those days as being a very, you know, very violent, very unsafe place to live. But it's funny, when you're in it, you don't see it. You know, you don't see the forest from the trees.
Yeah.
You're there. You're experiencing it. And I don't want to say that, you know, I had any bad experiences growing up there. You know, yeah, I knew a lot of criminals. I knew a lot of good people. And sometimes the criminals were probably some of the best people that I knew, which, you know, sounds crazy, but I mean, that's just reality. But for me, it was a great neighborhood. I loved it. My mother still lives there. I live out in the suburbs now, so I've kind of like changed my way of life and just, you know, my reality. And I love coming to visit. I don't know if I could live in the city again.
Okay.
But I love coming to visit because, you know, all those memories always come back.
So, but you do have the experience and the understanding, though, with your mother still living in the same house where you grew up. So you're there, you see it. Have things changed since your younger days?
Oh, absolutely. They have. They absolutely have. Growing up, you know, yeah, there was a lot of gangs and a lot of crews and you know, drugs, you know, it was a problem. It absolutely was, you know, so things have changed. And yeah, for the better. I mean, it's funny. Like, I remember when we moved back to October of 22, I just remember sitting on my mom's porch and it was, you know, towards the night, whatever, but seeing people like jogging, you know, like, and like that to me, just, you never saw that.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, it was just funny. Like, you know, wow. Like, why is a white lady jogging on our street? And, you know, she's just jogging just to, you know, to go out and have a run.
Right.
You know, that's something that we didn't see when I grew up there as a youth. So it has changed. There's a building right in front of my mother's home now, which had gone up where the old, Penn Advertising or Wilmer and Ferris, I believe it was.
Okay.
So, you know, things have changed for the better. I do kind of miss some of the old things from the neighborhood. Like, I was thinking about this the other day. You know, when I was a kid in high school, I used to work at Tops on Niagara. But the old Tops, the one
for the Perna family.
Yes.
Like I did in Hamburg, yes.
And I just remember, you know, going there, or even next door, there was the farmer's market right across the street from Mangione's, the hardware store. Mm-hmm. Like, those little things, like, it's nice to see, like, if I go on Niagara Street where there are still things that are there. But, like, we're all bakeries, you know, the Balisseries. They're out in Orchard Park, I believe, and Cristiano's bakery is gone. Like, those little things that I do miss.
Yeah.
And so, you know, yeah, I love going back, you know, to the West Side. I love going back to go visit my mom, you know, and seeing, yeah, things have changed for the better. But then it's like, oh, I kind of miss all the old things that I remember growing up and experiencing.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. Well, it's part of your youth, part of who you are, made you who you are.
No, and I tell people, like, you know, I tell my wife all the time, and I've shared this with other people, like, one of my biggest fears in life is like losing my memory, like losing those things that, you know, that I always kind of call back to, things that I could always appreciate, you know, because I don't know. I think that's probably why I got into being a documentary filmmaker, is because I love capturing people's experiences. I love interviewing, you know, folks of, you know, of older generations, for instance, because I have an opportunity to capture like life, how they saw it through their eyes. It's a gift that we can, you know, give to future generations whenever you can capture those experiences.
So with the Buffalo Latino Lens, how are you proceeding with this? What's obviously the title kind of speaks for itself to a certain extent.
Sure.
But it's going to be your unique approach. And like you said, you've got documentary experience. You also have been a columnist as well. So you have that kind of approach to things. And so I want to dive in a little bit here. How do you, you know, plan to proceed, and you know, what have you been working on so far?
Well, the idea of the program, it really just has been something that's kind of been festering for, I want to say, years. Working here, you know, working at Channel 7, and then being a Buffalo native, I never saw like Latinos or Puerto Ricans on television represented in a positive way for the most part. It's changed now, but I'm thinking about back,
sure,
you know, years ago. It used to frustrate me. They never showed us on television unless it was Hispanic Heritage Month. They never showed us on television unless we were in handcuffs or climbing a greasy pole.
Hmm.
That to me was frustrating. I remember going up to Bill Ransom's office when I worked at Channel 7, Bill Ransom, the general manager there at the time, because the, you know, news was running a program called The Wild West Side, Buffalo's Heroin Highway.
Whoa.
And the story was basically going through to kind of talk about the drug epidemic in the Lower West Side. And, you know, being a Lower West Side native, being someone who grew up on the Lower West Side, that kind of offended me, because, you know, who lives in the Lower West Side? At the time, it was, you know, predominantly Puerto Ricans. Mm. And that kind of like, I didn't like the fact that that was already shining a negative light on my part of town. And I went up there and I complained about it. I did, you know, I was vocal about it. But that experience, and just knowing like that, you know, we're never really have too much, I guess, representation,
right,
or we're not really shown, you know, within local media as much as I had wanted to see growing up. That's kind of what led me to just start developing this. You know, I have the experience, as he said, you know, I have the background. So why wait for someone else to shine a light on my community? You know, why not do it myself? And that's basically what I did. And that's what I'm doing. I want to spotlight the positive things in our community, whether it be cultural, whether it be businesses, you know, people doing positive things. Because, yeah, you know, everyone can turn on the news and see negative. But no, I want to like shine a light on the positivity that's going on in our community.
As I'm sure you well know, right, when you set out to talk about a community and you start getting into the positive aspects, it all of a sudden becomes kind of an endless list of things, doesn't it?
I mean,
it does. Once you really kind of take that look and go from, you know, a human individual standpoint, not, you know, grouping people under a headline, heroin highway. So what are you seeing? What are the things, I guess, to start? What are the things that maybe you're just tackling first off, because they're right there? But and then I also want to kind of get into some of the other things that you're maybe discovering as you're going through this process.
Well, the one thing that, well, I mean, we're here in Hispanic Heritage Month. One thing that I do want to kind of like acknowledge and really kind of focus on is that even though the program is Buffalo Latino Lens, so seeing Buffalo through the eyes of a Latino, basically. You know, we're here, we have different experiences. We're not just, you know, all falling under one umbrella. We
right.
have different cultures. We have, you know, just completely different viewpoints. So for instance, like, the first episode I'm doing, I'm going to be covering, an organization, a studio, art studio. They're called Amapola Arts. And, they're basically doing like Puerto Rican art
Okay.
And they're up in Tonawanda. Really great couple, Nino and Glissette Morales, Dr. Glissette Morales. I'm really excited to kind of show what they're doing, you know, promoting their culture through art, whether it be ceramics, whether it be through painting. And you know, I also have covered a group called Latinas Evolving, who they're promoting Latina businesses, you know, here locally. Because, you know, there are a lot of entrepreneurs that don't necessarily get an opportunity to kind of put themselves out there like that.
Right.
Another group that I've done some filming with is El Bate up in Riverside.
Sure. We were just there Friday, as a matter of fact. Yeah.
Yeah. And Beatriz, she actually was in my documentary, Boricua Soy Yo, years ago. But, you know, them telling, you know, or at least capturing and representing Puerto Rican culture through music and dance. That's something that I think everyone should know about,
right,
whether you're Puerto Rican or not. I've interviewed Santiago Masferrer over at El Buen Amigo, and I don't know if you know his story, but he was a political prisoner in Chile.
Ah, that's
during
Pinochet. You had a column on that, yeah.
During Pinochet. And his experience, and he immigrated here, I want to say in the late 70s, early 80s, and he worked in the prison system, you know, helping inmates. And just hearing his story, I mean, these are people in our community who are doing things that don't always have that chance to kind of like tell their stories. So that's kind of like what I'm trying to do with Buffalo Latino Lens. I want to shine a light, spotlight people, tell their stories. Because look, you know, I can, the news, they can cover like an organization, you know, and promote any organizations. I kind of want to go down and be more on a surface level.
Sure.
I don't want to be at the 10,000 foot level. I want to be on a surface level talking to people about what they're doing, you know, how they're trying to make an impact in their community.
With us this morning, Rocco Anastasio, Buffalo Latino Lens. Rocco, with a fairly extensive background, we talked earlier about a couple of documentaries that you were able to put together. One, in their words, of service and sacrifice. What did you learn there?
that one was heavy. So years ago, I worked for, this is when we were living in Florida. I was a freelancer. I had worked for the city of Deltona, Florida. I actually worked for the city as a full-time employee, became a public information officer with them. But prior to working as an employee for the city, I would do freelance work. And they asked me if I could cover a Veterans Day event and put together like a 5-minute video diary of that event. When I was there for Veterans Day ceremony that they had, I don't know what it was. Maybe it was because I had a camera in hand, but I had a lot of veterans that wanted to talk. And they just wanted to talk, and they did not stop talking. And, you know, that kind of like, that gave me an idea, you know, about doing a piece on veterans and their stories. So I was able to put together a feature-length documentary. I interviewed 5 veterans, one from the Second World War, 3 Korean War veterans, and 1 veteran from Vietnam. And, you know, they shared their stories. I think all but one of the veterans has passed away, but it was an amazing experience just to kind of like capture those stories. You know, we talked about earlier about capturing stories that you can share with generations later on. The one veteran who, there was one Korean War veteran, he was blind, and he was telling me these stories, and his granddaughter was sitting in the room while I was interviewing him. And, you know, he was telling me stories that she had never heard, that he had never shared with his family. And I felt humbled that he was able, that he shared that with me, that he was comfortable enough to share that with me. And it was just, a really heavy experience. I mean, I just remember him saying how, you know, he doesn't remember many things from his childhood. He doesn't remember, you know, any of the faces of his classmates. He doesn't remember any of the names of his teachers, but he remembers the first soldier. He was a MASH unit. He was on, you know, medic.
Right.
He remembers like his first day in that hill in Korea and seeing like the first man that he had to like attend to who passed away. And just, you know, he was blind, but I can like see in his eyes like that memory kind of coming back to him.
Wow.
It was just, yeah, really humbling.
It's interesting to hear you talk about that. And just, I guess maybe, are you finding that that was about veterans here, now you're focused on people in Buffalo. Are you finding that same type of thing once you get your subjects, your people in place, and you sit them down, that those stories do start coming out? Maybe, like you said, stories that maybe a lot of family members don't even know about.
I think so. I tried, whenever I'm, you know, sit a camera in front of a subject, I try to have a conversation with them. You know, yeah, I will prep them and tell them, okay, these are some of the subjects that I'm going to bring up, if you can share. But I find like just getting them to feel comfortable with me, you know, and of course you do your prep. I mean, you know, we talked before we started rolling here, you know, just kind of get a good feeling of how things are going to go. But I feel like people are open to tell their stories. And I think people also acknowledge like, you know, maybe if someone wants to capture my story, I should go ahead and tell it and be open about it. I tell people all the time whenever I'm interviewing people and you know, especially older folks, I wish I had a chance to interview my dad.
Right.
I wish I had a chance to capture his stories on camera. Same thing with my grandmother, because like those stories, when they're gone, they take them with them. It's like a recipe. Unless they write it down, you can try to mimic that recipe. It's never going to taste the same. But, you know, if you don't capture that, you know, those stories are just going to be lost when they go move on. But I feel people are very comfortable, you know, so long as you treat them with respect and you're, you know, you treat them, you know, just as a person and just show them that like, look, I have empathy. You know, I'm a person as well. So let's just treat it as if it were a normal conversation.
I wonder if also when you're doing, you know, your work for Buffalo Latino Lens or some of your previous work, working in writing columns as well, if you also have run into, though, people who, like the story you were telling me about Channel 7, you know, that the headline, the heroin highway, if you're also hearing from people who feel like you felt misrepresented, you know, totally cliched, stereotyped in the media in the past. Have you run into that type of conversation?
Personally, up to now, I can't say that I have, but I do see, you know, everyone has social media nowadays and people are very vocal online. And I do see people are very protective of whether it be their culture or whether it be others that might want to, like, you know, misrepresent them. I understand that. But I think we need to keep dialogue open because, you know what, if you have an opportunity to correct someone, there's nothing wrong with correcting them.
Right.
But at the same time, I feel like with that, there's also responsibility with how you're correcting people. So, yeah. I could have gone ahead and went down to the newsroom and then like, you know, just, you know, turned tables over and yelled and then, you know, got fired.
I was just going to say, the only thing that would change is your employment status.
Exactly. Got written up. But I figured, you know what, I'm not going to go and talk to the news director or the producer who did that piece. I'm just going to go upstairs and talk to the guy upstairs. And he listened and he understood where I was coming from. But that's the thing. I feel like, you know, if there are any opportunities for you to kind of get directly to the source or get to the point or like speak to someone who can make a difference or who can make a change or at least who will listen, you should do that. But you have to do it in a respectful way. You know, everyone has an opinion. If you have social media, you know, people are very opinionated on it. I try not to get involved in that as much. I'm using social media as a tool. I don't use it as, you know, something to go on there and complain about. But I feel like if people are being misrepresented or aren't seeing themselves being represented in a way that they want to be represented, I feel like, you know what, you know, do something with that, but do it in a way that's actually going to create change instead of just be another negative post online that's not going to go anywhere.
And speaking of social media, while I have you, Buffalo Latino Lens, can we find...
You can find Buffalo Latino Lens on Facebook, buffalolatinolens.com, on TikTok. I'm still, you know, I'm a certain generation, so I'm still trying to like understand TikTok and all
Once
that.
You do, send me a note and I'll figure it out myself. Rocco Anastasio with us here on What's Next this morning. Speaking of going to the source, you also went back to Puerto Rico not long after Hurricane Maria. Tell us what you saw.
So this was, I want to say, September of 2018, if I'm not mistaken. The company that I used to work for had sent a group of about 15 people down to Puerto Rico to help with relief efforts through an organization called All Hands and Hearts. And it was a humbling experience. We were in Yabucoa, which is like ground zero from where Hurricane Maria first landed on the island. And I spent about a week on a rooftop helping to refinish a gentleman's home who had just bought the house 2 weeks prior to the hurricane hitting. We were staying in an old schoolhouse in the gymnasium is where we slept, and bunk beds and cots. And there were about 70 people that were there volunteering at any given time. One thing that I had observed was, you know, being there, that you had people from Europe that were there volunteering, people from Central and South America that were volunteering. There were only about three other Puerto Ricans on base that were volunteering. And that really, it really upset me, you know, because for me, I felt like, you know, growing up here in Buffalo, in the West Side, if you go to New York City, whenever you see Puerto Ricans, you see them because they're waving their flag. They're very proud of their flag. And, you know, we talked about this off air, but if you're not familiar with it, you know, the Puerto Rican flag was, it was against the law to wave it at one time. So that's why whenever you see a Puerto Rican, you know they're Puerto Rican because they're waving that flag or they have a flag present somewhere. But being on the island and noticing that there were only two other Puerto Ricans that had gone down there to help with the relief efforts, it was troubling to me. And I remember speaking with the homeowner, and once he, you know, we got to talking, and, you know, I told him that my mother was from Sabana Grande, which is in the southwest of the island in the mountains. You know, his eyes lit up and he was happy because, you know, he felt like, oh, you know, one of us came down to help. But then he kind of, his eyes kind of turned sad because he asked, like, where are the rest? You know, where are the rest of our people? You know, we need their help and they're not coming. So that kind of, it really bothered me. And I came back home and I remember writing a Facebook post about it, long-winded Facebook post about, you know, our people need help. You know, why aren't we there helping them? So that really kind of, I guess that was actually the beginning, because when I was there, you know, I spent some time on the island, and that was like the beginning of my second documentary, Boricua Soy Yo, because it started to make me question, okay, my identity as a mainland-born Puerto Rican being on the island, and because, you know, there is a little bit of an identity crisis, you know, how they look at Puerto Ricans that grew up here versus Puerto Ricans on the island, you know, there's still that question about it.
If you don't mind, maybe explore that a little bit.
Well, like, you know, if you're, you know, in New York City, we have New Yorkicans. You know, that's how they refer to themselves.
Okay.
So are they true Puerto Ricans because they weren't born and raised on the island? So that's like, there's like a little bit, you know, some people on the island might not consider Puerto Ricans that are born here and raised here as true Puerto Ricans. But for me, it's the culture is in your blood. It's in your, you know, in your spirit, not necessarily where you're born.
And you also, just on a personal note, took your family.
Yes.
Down to Puerto Rico not too long ago.
Yes. We spent about a week back in, August, I want to say? Yeah. First week of August, we were down there celebrating my daughter and my son's birthdays. They turned 15 and 14. But we were there and just had a chance to experience and kind of just take in the island, take in the culture. And it was amazing. It was our first real family trip together. But it really kind of just makes you appreciate where you come from. And now, you know, my children, they're born here. They know nothing about their culture, but it's something that, you know, I felt like it was almost like a pilgrimage. Like we needed to go there because I wanted them to see where they came from.
And did you see a connection being built there? I mean, at the 14 to 15 year old, I'm not sure what I was thinking of when I was 14 or 15.
No, absolutely. Like, absolutely. Like, I saw, like, just seeing their faces light up whenever we would, like, go to different places, you know, go to El Morro and Viejo San Juan and just go around to different areas of the island. And, of course, the beaches and going through the rainforest and Andayunque. I mean, it was just beautiful to see them in their element, I almost want to say.
Sure. As we touched upon El Bate, got a chance to go over there last week and, you know, talk about a learning experience, you know, just getting into the history of not just, you know, Puerto Rican people living here in Buffalo, but also Puerto Rico in itself. I guess from your perspective now, as somebody who's done, you know, you're looking at things as a documentarian to a certain extent now, as a producer of the Buffalo Latino Lens. What, you know, there's obviously a lot. We could probably have a whole show of just things that people should know or should understand about the culture. But for you, what are some of the main points
of
the Puerto Rican culture that, you know, again, you know, we kind of started off our conversation about sure. some, you know, stereotypes that were embedded by media, but you know, when it comes right down to it, I mean, what are some of the lessons that you'd like to see, or understanding that you'd like to see the general populace understand?
For me, like, we're very warm people. We're warm. We're inviting. We love to have a great time. You know, we love to just, you know, welcome people into our lives. You know, we're not standoffish people. We're also very proud of our history, proud of our, you know, our culture, you know, and there's a lot of really traumatic history, you know, on the island. And, but we're proud of that. And we tell, like, you know, with the, you know, through Bomba Music, you know, using yep. El Bate as an example, a lot of that history and that, you know, a lot of that is told through dance, through song. And that's just, you know, one of the things that I find so important is that, you know, we need to, like, preserve our history. We need to preserve, you know, whether the good and the bad, and be open to sharing that with everyone. Like, Puerto Rico's a small island. You know, there's a big, I want to, you know, rivalry with, in sports, like with Puerto Rico in boxing, for instance.
Okay.
If you were to look it up, you know, Mexico is a huge, huge country compared to Puerto Rico, but there is a huge rivalry between Mexican fighters and fighters from the island. And just because, you know, we're a small island, you know, we've had so many amazing people that have come from that island, scientists, astronauts, sports figures. Of course, you can talk about the entertainment industry. I mean, there's so many positive people have come out of that small little island in the Caribbean. And that's something that I feel like, you know, we need to acknowledge and appreciate, especially being Puerto Ricans here on the mainland.
Coming down to our final moments here with Rocco Anastasio of Buffalo Latino Lens. So this is something that's going to be airing on WBBZ, right?
Yes, sir.
But also online as well.
Yes.
So what do you see? What can we expect here in the coming months?
Well, I'm approaching it as a monthly program for now, because it's really me, myself,
right,
doing it.
And we should also acknowledge, we haven't said this during the show, this is just a passion project of yours. You got a full-time gig like everybody, like a lot
Absolutely.
Of other people are trying to, you know,
Absolutely.
To produce this stuff. So you've got a lot of work, even though you have experience, you got a lot of work ahead of yourself
absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely. It's quite the lift. I do have a friend of mine I've known for 25 years, my friend Sean Davenport, who's helping me with some of the filming. But as far as, like, scheduling of the interviews, filming, editing, a lot of that is on my shoulders.
Right.
And so it is a heavy lift. We're premiering on the 24th of September at 8 p.m. I'm excited about it. And like I said, it's an opportunity that I have to kind of present my community, you know, locally here.
Right.
Because, again, going back to the beginning of this conversation, I've always felt like we were underrepresented locally here in local media. So that's why I wanted to just go ahead and do my part and taking a bull by the horns and doing the work and representing ourselves.
That will do it for today's show. We'll be back on Wednesday when Jay Moran speaks with producer Steven Rosenthal and actor Stephen McKinley Henderson about their upcoming documentary, It's Up to Us, which will be screened on Saturday, September 27th. This has been What's Next from Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.